rest assured. Do what God is telling you to do now, and you can depend on this. He will show you what to do next.
Thanks for joining us for Mission 66, brought to you by TWR in partnership with the Bible Teaching Ministry of Dr. Luis Seau. Today, we continue our discovery of the Book of Esther, which tells of a courageous young Jewish woman in Persia during Israel's exile. Download the free study guide at mission66.org. Let's join John Matthews and host Esther Sisulu as they lead us through our study.
Welcome, dear friends, and thank you for joining us today as we read in the book of Esther, who lived hundreds of years before Jesus Christ. Now, she lived in the kingdom of Persia, whom God brought into the palace in Susa, the capital, just in time to foil a deadly plot against her people. Well, let's welcome our teacher, John Matthews, who will take us to chapters 3 and 4 with the theme, For Such a Time as This.
Esther, thank you so much, and a very warm welcome to this latest episode of Mission 66. Great to have your company, and so good to be with you as we reach another captivating episode in the book of Esther. If you've been following us here on Mission 66 and joining us, we've been seeing how this Jewish orphan girl, whose Hebrew name was Hadassah, is raised by a close relative whose name is Mordecai. It's her uncle. And there's these series of pretty unique events happening because she becomes Queen Esther, the favourite wife of King Xerxes in the Persian Empire. And this is all happening in the 5th century BC before Christ. In chapter 3 now, we read about an enemy of the Hebrews whose murderous intent is prevalent. And his aim is to wipe out the Jews. And when the chapter reads the king's name as Ahasuerus, well, that is the Hebrew translation of his better known name, which is Xerxes the Great. So let's read Esther chapter 3, verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down, and they paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. We'll talk more about Haman and his ancestors a little later, but let's continue now in verse 7, which says, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, they cast lots, before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you." Now, this bureaucratic correspondence was actually treated as routine. Xerxes didn't know what he was doing, and so he becomes an unwitting partner in Haman's attempt to commit genocide. And in signing the death warrant of all the Jews, he's likewise condemning his own queen, because Esther and Mordecai, well, they have Jewish background. And this explains why Mordecai didn't bow down to Haman, because Mordecai would bow down to none other than God. And verse 12 says, "Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces, and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script, and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, kill, and annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion." How often governors and people in authority make these laws that maybe at a whim, or certainly benefit themselves. And meanwhile, what do? They sit down and drink, whilst the people are thrown into confusion under such oppression. So this is dating all the way back to the Persian Empire, but I think perhaps fair to say that not a lot has changed under the sun. And we get to Esther 4, where it says this: "When Mordecai learnt all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes, and he put on sackcloth and ashes. And he went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. And he went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate covered in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting. And many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he may take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. And so Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favour and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, 'All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law: to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. So Esther is distressed about this edict that condemned her people, but she knew that if she went into the king uninvited, it could well cost her life. But then Mordecai's reply to Esther has become a well-known saying. This is verse 13. "Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And there's a time to be silent. There's also a time to speak up. And so Esther faces this moral dilemma of great weight, and much would hang on what she would do. Verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him.
You are following along in our reading of the book of Esther in the Old Testament, looking at chapters 3 and 4 with our teacher John Matthews here on Mission 66. Well, we're going to segue into some questions. And so, John, let's talk about Haman. What can we actually say about him? What irritated him so much that he decided to persecute the Jewish people?
Well, this idea, Esther, of intolerance towards the Jewish people is not something that only happened in Persia. It also happened later in Greece and indeed in Europe in recent history. But Haman was one particular chap who was called an Agagite. Now, the implication is that he descended from Agag, who was the king of the Amalekites, who were enemies of Israel historically, of course, during the days of King Saul. And God had told, if you remember, King Saul to destroy the Amalekites centuries earlier, including their king. And you may remember we saw in 1 Samuel that Saul failed to obey the command. He allowed Agag to live, and God foresaw that if this Amalekite were allowed to live, his descendants would always be a threat to the Jews. And lo and behold, here comes a descendant, and his name is Haman.
Well, that's correct. So how is it then, John, that Agag had descendants, considering how Samuel the prophet killed Agag after he rebuked Saul for keeping him alive?
Yeah, that's a good recollection, and you're keeping me on my toes today, as always, Esther. Yeah, you're quite right, because that is exactly what happened. But what Saul didn't do is follow God's command to wipe out the peoples, and so the king had offspring right and left. And who knows, Agag may well have lived long enough between Saul keeping him alive and Samuel ending his life to enable the conception of a child. It's not told to us, but one way or another, we know that Haman was from the line of Agag.
Yeah, you can really tell that Haman hated the Jews, so much so that he was planning on annihilating the entire nation. But the question here is why, John? I mean, he was even successful in turning the populace against the Jewish nation.
Yeah, one thing we know about Haman is that he was a proud man, because he goes to the gate and Haman doesn't bow down to him. And he is filled, we're told in the chapter, with rage. And so here was a guy who thought an awful lot of himself. How dare that person not bow down to me? It's hard for us to get our heads around. So there was something flawed in Haman's character, no doubt about that. And it was channeled, his rage, towards the Jewish population here, because Mordecai, who hadn't bowed down to him, was a Jew. And so it seems petulant and even evil. And, you know, the question arises, who can explain how such hatred arises in the human heart? But look, each and every one of us is capable of that kind of hatred if we allow ourselves to go unchecked and we surround ourselves by enough influences from a very young age. You know, we can be influenced. And the idea that, you know, we're all peace-loving brothers is not backed up by even a cursory glance through history. You know, right now, there are more than 50 ongoing conflicts in the world at the time of recording this. And in those 50 conflicts, 92 countries are involved in conflicts beyond their own borders. And so the scene was set in the Garden of Eden when sin entered the world. And tragically, there has been butchery and interracial hatred ever since. And this particular conflict has surfaced during the Persian Empire because the Persians were different from the Jewish people in thought and practice. And it may seem incredulous to us, but it's difference that often unites people in many ways. But in some instances, when there's sin in the room, it does the opposite. It pulls people apart. And there was just difference here, something that we often celebrate here is despised. And you have the Jews following the precepts of the law of Moses, and they refused to bow before idols. And that's what provoked Haman, who demanded to be worshipped as if he was a god, a man given a little bit of power, having no idea how to respond to that. And evidently, even though the population was willing to tolerate it, and even we get the idea of incorporate the Jews to living with them, there may well and there must have been some underlying resentment, and that shows itself in the character of Haman, and he's beyond his control because it fans into this angry flame.
Well, John, you know, in chapter 4, we do see Mordecai giving us that famous line, "For such a time as this." But it's also in this chapter that he says to Esther that if she didn't speak up to save her people, that the deliverance of the Jews would have arisen from another place. So where do you think that help and deliverance would have come from if she did not step up?
Yeah, that's a great quote that just conveys a sense of faith that Mordecai has in God. He's like, well, God is God, and so God brings good from bad situations. And so if you're not going to do it, somebody else will. I think that's a real lesson for us today, actually. There are opportunities to step into God's work, which is the most thrilling, exhilarating. Yes, there'll be suffering along the way, but it leads to heaven. And this reward, the greatest reward, is to spend eternity with him and whatever else he adds to that. And so, you know, Mordecai sees that. So there's real insight and wisdom that comes through in this quote. It's a great thing that he said. He's confident that God is not going to allow his people to be wiped out. Not happening. He had done it plenty of times in the past, and he'll do it plenty of times in the future for us as well. You remember the time when the Assyrian army surrounded Samaria, and later when they surrounded Jerusalem under Hezekiah. I don't know if Mordecai was expecting deliverance from human means. And in a way, it doesn't matter what iota, because Mordecai had a faith in God that wasn't dependent upon human means. He had a whole load of confidence in God and his ability to deliver his people in whatever way that God chose to do. And so he was able to live very comfortably, whilst others were, as we read in the chapter, there was distress and there's weeping and there's panic. Not Mordecai. Mordecai understands who God is, and he's living in the moment. And how often we, as humans, we think way ahead, don't we? And the problem with that, you know, Esther, is that we miss what God has put right in front of our noses today, in the here and the now. And, you know, God only really trusts future development with those who honour him today. Elizabeth Elliot puts it in a lovely way when she said, "Does it make sense to pray for guidance about the future if we're not obeying in the thing that lies before us today? How many momentous events in the Bible depended on one person's seemingly small act of obedience? Rest assured, do what God tells you to do now and depend upon it, because you will be shown what to do next." Isn't that great? And for Esther, that meant walking in to the king uninvited. And what did she say? Well, if I perish, I perish. But the thing she had to do for future blessing was do the tough thing here and now.
Oh, yeah, that's so true, John. And it's because of that confidence in God that we now understand that the Jews celebrate this deliverance in the holiday known as Purim. So what is the connection here, and where did the name of this celebration come from?
Well, Purim was the Persian word that meant lot, the casting of lots. And the Persian word Purim became the name for which the holiday is actually known, and their deliverance was celebrated by the Jews. Haman, believing Persian ideas, he cast lots to determine the most fortuitous day to carry out his scheme. Now, it's possible that astrology had some part in what he was doing, but as it turns out, the day he picks for the execution of his deadly plan was nearly a year away. And that gives the people time to mount a defence, and it gives Esther time to expose Haman to the king. Now, remember, Haman had no idea that Esther was a Jew, but he was going to find out.
All right, well, let's talk about the significance of that signet ring, the king's signet ring that he gave to Haman.
Yeah, in the ancient world, kings used signet rings in the place of personal signatures. So the ring had a raised mark on it, and that was specially designed by each king as his personal imprint maker. So he would effectively sign letters or documents by pressing the back of the ring down into a blob of soft wax, which meant do not open except on official business. And that was also on official documents, and they were certified the same way. So by giving Haman his signet ring, Xerxes is giving him pretty much a blank check, as it were, which carried with it the authority to do anything that he wished. And the reality is the king should have been a little bit more investigative when it came to Haman before giving him that kind of power.
Now, John, we know that Esther was clearly risking her life going to the king uninvited, because if he hadn't held out his golden scepter for her, then she would have lost her life. She would have been killed. I don't know. To me, it doesn't quite make sense, though, considering she was a queen. So what was that scenario all about?
Yeah, no, Esther was the queen, and the law of the Medes and the Persians stated that nobody could approach the king unless he remembered to hold out this golden scepter. So she's not guaranteed safe passage despite being the queen. And so there is real risk involved here.
Yeah, you know, Esther's attitude in approaching the king was, if I perish, I perish. Now, in my eyes, she was being quite courageous, quite brave. But was this bravery, or was she just resigned to her fate regardless of what happened?
Oh, look, it takes tremendous courage to do what she does here. She has no idea really what's going to happen. Xerxes was a man to whom human life was very cheap. But she arrives at a place in her mind and her heart where the welfare of other people takes precedence over her own personal safety. We sometimes hear the phrase, look out for number one, don't we, nowadays? And boy, it's a self-centered way of operating. And I don't think anybody, well, I speak for myself, we don't need encouragement to live for ourselves, because we're wired that way. Someone once said, the heart is bent inwards on itself. It's as much as we can do with God's grace to bend that heart back out to other people, because we're innately looking after number one. We need no encouragement to do that. But Esther's attitude here, and it reflects the state of her heart, it's the opposite. She knew what she had to do, even if it were to cost her life. And you're right, she says, if I perish, I perish. What an impact we would have on the world as people of faith and lovers of Jesus Christ if we had the same commitment to do the right thing. When I talk about the right thing, I'm talking about the way of Jesus Christ, the way he lived, the fruit of the Spirit, doing things the right way. If we did that, I'm telling you, the world around us would change.
You know, I'm thinking, John, on one hand, deliverance in some senses depended on Esther and her taking action, right? But on the other hand, and I think ultimately what I'm saying is that it depended on God, because he's the one who brought about the deliverance for the people. And this is why I'd say Esther told the people to pray and to fast.
Well, Proverbs 3 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. Three things there. We've got to trust him with all of our heart. We've got to make sure we don't, when all of our heart is not engaged, be tempted to wander back to our own understanding. Oh, I need to do a bit quicker than this, Lord. And in all our ways, we acknowledge him. So we give him our whole heart and we trust him with everything. And we disregard our own fallen human logic. And then in every single thing we do, every part of the day, he is front and centre. We're acknowledging him. What happens then? Stuff you'll never ever believe or imagine. He directs your path. And when you're in that path, there's no stopping you nor I. That is what Esther does here. And for such a time as this, yeah, it's a verse that's quoted from Esther. But it could be the mantra for your life as well. If you can do this, trust in the Lord. And if I can do this, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all of your ways, acknowledge him. And he will direct your path.
Well, what a great way to lead into our summary, John. A beautiful encouragement. So how do we summarize Esther chapter 3 and chapter 4?
Well, look, the story of Esther is revealing to us incredible courage, incredible faith, and God's providence rewarding that courage and faith. Amidst the looming threat of effectively what was genocide, you have Esther, Jewish orphan raised by Mordecai. She becomes queen of Persia, but her people are facing annihilation when Haman, a descendant of Israel's ancient enemy Agag, manipulates the king Xerxes to issue a decree for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai had refused to bow to him, setting off what would soon be the prospect of at least a murderous rampage. Esther hesitates to intervene due to the risk of approaching the king uninvited, which could mean her immediate death. And then Mordecai reminds her, though, of her unique position, saying, "Who knows whether you've not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Esther rallies prayer support thereafter, and there's fasting involved, and they resolve to go ahead. And she says, "If I perish, I perish." Next episode, we're going to see what happens.
And we'll be looking for you to join us then, dear friends, same time, same place, as we continue reading in the book of Esther, the queen who came to the kingdom for such a time as this. Well, my name is Esther, and I'd like to thank you for joining us, and for our team and for our teacher, John Matthews, saying we'll see you next time on Mission 66.
Has God used today's program in your life? Then you'll want to receive the free study guide that's waiting for you on our website. You can get it right away by downloading it at mission66.org. At mission66.org, you can also leave a comment or make a donation to help this listener-supported ministry. When you give, you're helping listeners experience solid Bible teaching in many languages in some of the most spiritually resistant places in the world. Thank you for helping at mission66.org. Mission 66 is a ministry of Transworld Radio.